Hey, hey, Syndication Memory Club. It's time for another edition of the monthly George Ross Mastermind.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to our monthly mastermind with Mr. George Ross. George, of course, worked in the Trump Organization for a good chunk of his career, in business for over 60 years, taught at the law school at NYU for over 20 years, author of two best-selling books. We're just super fortunate to have George here with us each and every month to answer our questions. Welcome.
Yeah, good to be here.
Well, George, we'll start out with something that's been in the news in your area. Of course, the big announcement in New York is the Amazon announcement in Long Island City, part of Queens. What's your perspective on the announcements and the impact that it's going to have both on the city, the residents, positive, negative? What are your thoughts?
Well, that's good. I believe any time that you do something like this, you're going to have pluses and minuses. The people in the neighborhood are going to say it's terrible, because it's going to upset. You're going to have traffic problems. You're going to overload the subways and your stores can't handle it. This is all, you know, not in my backyard type NIMBY, they call it. And it doesn't make a difference what it is you're going to put up, a school or a college or anything like that. There are going to be a number of them that are going to resist it. That's got to happen. However, looking at it from the big picture, it's going to bring in a lot of jobs to the city and to the state. Because there are taxes which are going to be paid upon the income that you have it, and these people are going to add to the money that's taken in by the city of New York and the local stores. So any time that you have it, you have to give inducements. And the only way that you're going to get one of these companies to go in your area, you're going to have to give them inducements. So you give them benefits. You may give them cash allowances or tax benefits that they don't have to pay taxes for a period of time. And you have to do it. That's the only way you're going to get them. And the states that have had companies come and set up factories or businesses in the area have given them some type of a financial incentive. It has to be. And it's appropriate. It's something that should be done. I mean, I know when I set up a factory in Albuquerque, outside Albuquerque, and I went to the state of New Mexico and told them I'm looking to set up a factory. And I said, I need a land. They said, how much land do you need? I said, 20 acres. He says, we'll get you 20 acres at a dollar an acre if you bring in 100 people. So, you know, that's part of it that they wanted to get jobs in that particular area. It wasn't in Albuquerque. It was one of the outskirts there, but this is what has to be. And the smart states or the smart cities are ones that are going to make all kinds of, inducements to get as many as thousands of workers that are going to be in their particular area. And it's definitely a push for the city of New York. So, you know, it's one of these things that I think is very good, but you're going to have a lot of negative feedback from the people in the area that don't see the benefit of having a monster facility such as this in their backyard.
You know, one of the criticisms has been that, you know, divide $3 billion of inducements by 25,000 employees, it comes to, you know, almost $150,000 or $120,000 per employee that the city or the state of New York is giving to Amazon. It seems like an excessive amount of money.
Yeah, but understand, wait a minute, let's get this one. On the inducement, this is money that they would never get. In other words, it wasn't the question that Amazon was going to give them $3 billion. It's just that they're going to get $3 billion in inducements. So it means they'll have no tax payments for a period of 10 years or what have you, in order to get it. But it's not money coming out of the city's pocket initially. They're not paying.
Right.
But as far as Amazon is concerned, yes, they can save money in taxes and they can get all kinds of inducements. It's the equivalent for them of getting the millions of dollars, but it's not coming out of the city's coffers initially. You're coming out of it if the program goes through. They would get the benefits. But hey, this is what happens. This is how you get companies to be in your area. You've got to do something creative.
Do you see any negatives from your perspective?
The negative is just the effect that it's going to have in the area. The transportation system is pretty overloaded. They got all kinds of subways there. How the people, where they're going to live, I don't know. You know, you're talking about housing a lot of people. The housing is pretty tight in Queens and certainly in the New York area. So that's as far as a negative is concerned. I don't, as far as the people working there, you know, how much money they're going to make, they're going to pay a lot of it in just income, you know, income, rental income.
Right.
I question whether or not it's how good it's going to be, what they're going to have to pay, what Amazon's going to have to pay in order to get their employees, because the standard of living in Queens or in New York is very high. The cost of living is high. So that's certainly something to be considered. But obviously, Amazon has taken this into consideration. Usually when these big companies do this at that point, they do an awful lot of spade work as to what the demographics are and what they can expect and as far as the labor force. And they're pretty smart in what they do. And then they go out and effectively bargain it to the highest bidder in various locations. Smart business for Amazon, and for the area that gets it, it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think it's exciting for the New York area. I think it's going to bring a lot of vibrancy to the area, and they're good paying jobs. I think they're obviously going to be competing with a number of the startup companies in the area for talent. But I think ultimately it's going to bring more talent to the New York area.
I think that absolutely. And also Amazon is on the cutting edge of everything. You know, they're really way ahead as far as using the artificial intelligence and using all kinds of systems that are available, the computers and cloud, and so they're way up there. And I think that's very good, because I think it's at a high level. So these are not low level jobs.
Correct.
So all things I think is good, but you know, to be seen. There'll be a lot of pluses and a lot of the negatives, as there already have, but a few positives. But it's something that'll work as well. I think it's good for the city and good for the state. Definitely.
Fantastic. Well, why don't we go to questions from the attendees? Why don't we start with Mark Rossioli? You're on the line. I think you can press *6 to unmute, or I can unmute you here. Mark, are you there?
Okay. I am here. I am now unmuted. How are you, Victor?
Very good.
Okay. What's our question, Mark?
Thanks, George. So we have a multifamily apartment building. It's currently under construction. The general contractor completed foundations, part of the masonry, manufacturing of the steel, and we recently paid this GC a $100,000 draw. One of the two partners of the GC firm emptied out the company's bank account and disappeared. Mm-hmm. The other partner is unable to pay the subcontractors, but he does remain committed to helping the project to completion. Mm-hmm. He's been on site the last couple of weeks overseeing the work, but it's clear that the GC partner is in deep financial distress. Our confidence in their ability to complete the project is low. So there are two parts to this. If we replace the GC, we need to get the GC to assign the building permit to another GC, and they may object. Secondly, the recovery of the lost $100,000 is important. We do not have lien waivers from the subs, and we'll probably have to pay for the work twice, but out of pocket. What would you do in this situation, George?
Well, the first thing is looking at it and say, what I would do in this situation is I would never have gotten into the situation.
Well,
never at
yes.
that point. In other words, I don't know that this what kind, who gave you the advice or had legal advice, but when a GC at this point, I would not pay a GC unless he pays his subs or gets waivers of lien. I wouldn't do it. Now, did the GC give you a firm contract saying he'll build it for X number of dollars, or is he?
Yes, we have a big. We have a fixed price contract.
You have a fixed price contract. Good. Why didn't you get? I'm in too late now. I would have gotten it bonded. I would have gotten the GC bonded that he's going to deliver. So
hindsight is 20/20. Yes, absolutely.
You're paying the insurance fee for the bonding, but at least you know that they're going to be responsible. Now, assuming that was, I mean, this is past history. You can always say what you should have done. Let's concentrate on what actually happened. I would not pay when you paid the $100,000. It should have been paid as against pay it to the subs. No, make the
correct. Correct. I agree. I agree with that. And a grave error was made.
No, not with the error, but nevertheless, at this now, what you've got, you got the situation. You got a GC who's got no money, who is still doing services. Okay.
Correct.
That's where you are. Okay. Now. I would basically, if you're satisfied with him that he's an honorable guy, at this ultimately he would get a fee when the job is complete. I don't know what it is. I wouldn't pay him a fee along the way because of the arrangement, because of what happened with his partner. But nevertheless, going forward, I would basically say, okay, we will continue on. We will pay the bills that are due, but you have to, we want to know that you got waivers of liens from the subs and against the bills and a certification from the architect that this work has been completed. So if you're paying somebody for steel and you're paying them 50% of the steel, you want to know, okay, that 50% of the steel is there. And the architect will certify, or whatever it is done to the percentage of completion. So it's basically having a supervising architect that works with the GC, and the GC asks for the money for the subs and basically pays the subs, but you give the checks directly to the subs in exchange for a waiver of lien. So that's going forward.
Yes. Thank you. Now,
the only other solution is you don't trust the GC. And you get another GC to do the work, which case you got a problem with $100,000.
I mean,
he's dealing with a thief, and that was unknown to him or unknown to you. And it's just one of these things, you know. That's when you got a thief. It's a thief is a thief, and you have to basically go ahead and continue on getting the building permit. I don't think the building permit, basically, it may be issued to the GC, but it goes early for the site. So I don't think that would be a problem. And I think also, I think the GC, from what you're telling, what I'm hearing from you, is that this guy is honorable. He had a thief for a partner.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So I would say, give him the benefit of the doubt. Let him finish it. And he would get a fee, a construction fee based on the job, but not only when the job is complete, whatever he gets. I don't know what you agree to pay him, a certain percentage, I assume, of the total cost of construction.
Sure. So if there's anything left after the $100,000 theft, you would give them the balance, maybe?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I would not know that at that point. I would also, you know, it's important, let the guy work on the job, do the job, and then just whether you've got to give him, whether you take $100,000 off his fee or whether you take less than $100,000 because he's got a situation that was beyond his control, and you want to give something along the way to make the job complete. I would, you know, there's merit to it. It's one of these things, but to ask him to take $100,000 hit because he had a crook for a partner, that's tough. But
it is.
That's your problem. I mean, that's your situation. I think that the main thing is to get him to do the work, do the job, and ultimately you're going to give him his fee, all or in part, or something, some way of recouping for the fact that he's going forward in a difficult situation. You need his cooperation.
I do. Correct.
Okay. Mark, but in the future, at that point, well, you got a fixed price contract, which is there. Then get it bonded in one way or another. Now, I don't like fixed price contracts. I would prefer cost plus.
Okay.
Okay. The reason for that is in the fixed price contract, what happens if there's an overrun? He eats it.
He eats it, correct.
Right. Now, on the other hand, if it happens to be an overrun, he's going to figure out how to save money so that he doesn't have the overrun. So you may end up with less construction, a little shoddy construction where he wants to recapture the fact that he's got these overruns. So as a general rule, I would suggest at this point, that you have a cost plus. So you have an opportunity, or he basically gives you, comes up with the subs. He says, here are the subcontracts, and he asks you to approve these subs. So now you know exactly how much he's paying for the steel because of the fact that he's got it in the subs. And they come on all of the trades, comes up with signed contracts with good subs so that he doesn't have to eat the subs, but they're going to be good subs, and you're going to pay these subs as the work is done. That's a better way to do it. It's a good experience for the future. It's not much we can do under this situation because it's already there. But, you know, this is a learning experience.
Of course.
Expensive learning experience, but that's what it is.
Do you have any advice on recouping the $100,000 that was stolen? Any insight on a path there?
How are you going to do it if you find if you can locate the thief? Then the answer is, yeah, sure. But how do you do that? If the guy guy emptied out the funds and disappeared, how are you going to get it back? I mean, unless they have some type of insurance, which I doubt, which is for the members of the partnership, where they have some type of insurance where there is a thievery that's involved. I doubt it, but just check on it. It doesn't sound to me like they would, but
yeah, I did. I did check, and they don't. You're correct.
Okay. So that's yes. Scratch that. That's good if it's there, but it doesn't. And other than that, I just say make the best out of a bad situation, and hopefully, and that the job, if the job is good, the cost will get eaten up. How much was the cost of the job? It was a big job.
Well, it was the entire job was only $1.1 million, so it was 9% of the job.
Well, that in that case, so you can't. Yeah. It's not that much profit there, but it's going on. Okay, it happens.
It does.
It happens. You learn. This is how you learn.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's great advice. Thank you, George.
Good luck.
Appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome.
Okay.
Okay. What else we got?
So, George, in your book, Trump Style Negotiation, you had a chapter where you wrote about convincing the other side that they're getting more than they ever expected. And, certainly Donald seems to sometimes stretch the positive. And he clearly believes that that's...
Wait. What do you mean sometimes stretch the positive? He always stretches the positives, always exaggerates.
Okay.
Now, go ahead.
So I guess the question is, if you're, it's I guess really a question about expectation setting, partly, because if they're getting more than they expected, you've got on the one hand a posture that says to really accentuate the positive, and then how do you actually deliver more than's expected in that kind of an environment? Or do you set the expectations low and then over deliver? What are your thoughts on them?
No, not the expectations low. Again, we're dealing here. One of the basic problems is a fuzzy, very fuzzy arrangement. Mm-hmm. And it really depends on the particular transaction. But you would give the whoever's on the other side and what they anticipate to get from the transaction, and you say, okay, this is we'll give you there. I mean, you may give them more money if it turns out to be a wonderful hit. It works well, and it's a big windfall. Yeah, I'll give you some more money on it. On the other hand, at that point, you may give them some publicity that's involved, that they're involved, that this is their project, which adds stature to their stature in the community, so that they're involved. This is their project, that effectively somehow you're going to put them on the front, get them some front headlines that they're what's involved at this project. So it's not necessarily money that's involved. You're not giving them necessarily more money, but you're going to tell them how it's going to inure to their benefit. It's not going to make your reputation. It's going to be, how the publicity is going to be handled, so that whatever you can throw something on the table, it doesn't necessarily have to be money. There could be money if this project turns out good, but then you're saying, good, here, this is what you're getting, but now you got to take a little less, but if it works well, I'll give you more. So you're going to get less in the going, but you got to share the upside, which will get you more than anticipated, but you shouldn't share 100% on a project which is yet to be completed.
Would you have an example of something that where you found a more than expected situation that you were involved in a specific negotiation?
Yeah. I had a situation at that point where we're buying had nothing to do with Trump, but you had a situation where there was a family that had a apartment house in a very wonderful area in Brooklyn, and it was built by the family. They held father who built it, this was his pride and joy. So he had it, and the property was never available for sale, although it would have brought a very attractive price when it went up for sale. Now, when the owner died and the family put it up, and now in order to tie up the property without it going into an auction, bidding auction, what we offered them was we would name his houses. So it would be always his father's, their father's name would be on this project forever. And anybody who went past it would see his name. Now, that was an extra added incentive. And they to say, well, we're going to honor your father. Meanwhile, the price is going to be what it is. But this is one of the things we would give where somebody else at that point would not necessarily give you the naming right. So you throw something in that would be attractive to them.
I love that. That's a great example.
And that for them to why they should deal with you rather than somebody else.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love that.
And this goes in, it goes anything. Why they should deal with you? Yeah, your money is better at that point. You'll put the PR that goes out will show how smart they were. You're giving them intangibles. In other words, it's not money, but it's something that would add to their stature. And when you say exaggerate, you're going to tell them how good it is, you know, how much they're going to make, and you push it up. If you give them a layout of exactly what you're planning on doing, you can puff it up. I anticipate making 10 million. That's anticipation. Realistically, you know, you're looking to make 5, but you anticipate 10. So you can do that. You don't have to have it doesn't have to be ironclad, because it's just anticipation. So you convince the other side this is going to be better than what you thought. I'll give you a share of the profits. I'll give you a share of the upside. And here's what it is. I plan right now, according to my projections and my business plan, you're going to end up getting an extra 100,000 or an extra $1 million, whatever it is. Yeah, they like that if you put it in your plan. That's all speculation, but it looks good when you put it in writing.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Okay, very good. Thank you, George.
Okay.
You're next, welcome. Next question is from Sepp. Sepp, are you on the line?
Hi, Victor and George. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, Sepp. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. It's kind of long, so I'll do my best to summarize it. George, we're selling a package of multifamily properties to a 1031 buyer, and mm-hmm. we're currently scheduled to close by the end of the month.
Okay.
And we need this closing to happen because we have a couple of new acquisitions lined up afterwards. And the buyer's lender just informed us last week that one of our buildings is part of the package, a 6-unit building, encroaches onto the neighboring property next door.
What do you mean encroaches on it? What, the building is on it? The building is over the lot line?
Correct. So,
or it's not. It's, in other words, it's not an alleyway. It's actually the physical building.
Correct. Yeah. From what my broker said, it appears that when the city drew the property boundaries, that original surveyor messed up.
Okay.
So, the owner of the neighboring property is also the former owner of our 6-unit building, mm-hmm. and they originally offered us the chance to buy both the apartment building and the house next door, but we just opted to buy the 6-unit. We did seller financing. Mm-hmm. Our title company prepared an encroachment agreement, and the neighbor is basically trying to extort us for $20,000 to sign that. They got wind of the sale, and they're basically trying to take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. So we do have title insurance, but the mistake I made when I first bought this is I did not order land surveys, and the title insurance company does have provision that protects them from this situation.
Without a survey, right. Okay.
Right. So my broker researched the county records, and again, it seems like the property boundaries is the error with it. I've already spoken with two attorneys. They reviewed the purchase contract, the promissory note we have with that neighbor insurance policy. And they said that our only options are, unless we can prove that the neighbor knew about this title issue beforehand when they sold us the 6-unit building, that we would basically have to pay them $20,000 or work with the city to redraw the boundaries. So for what it's worth, the neighbor is also a local wealthy investor, and all the buildings that they own under their name instead of an LLC. And they have given us the option to buy the house next door, but they want a $50,000 market premium. Mm-hmm. So if I could ask, what would you do if you were in my shoes?
Well, one thing at this point, when you bought it from the present seller at that point, did he take back some paper?
He did.
He did? Okay.
Yes.
I would stop paying the paper.
And well.
Here's what you got. You got to do it. The problem is if you can work it out time-wise, fine. So if all things being equal, if you can hold off your prospective purchaser or delay the prospective purchaser, then I would go after the seller, as that this is in effect, he knew or should have known of this encroachment when he sold you the property.
Okay. One thing I should mention, we did do a cash out refinance and we paid that off. Does that make a difference?
What do you mean?
So we refinanced the paper about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And, But the lender that we had at that time was aware of the encroachment. They were okay with it, but buyer's lender is not okay with it. So unfortunately, we don't have the power to stop making the payments because they're not getting payments anyway right now.
No, okay, but meanwhile, you got a legitimate lawsuit.
Oh,
you got a legitimate lawsuit against the owner. This is something he knew. He had the property and he should have known of this encroachment. Now you can also there are a number of other areas there is such a thing as an easement by prescription, all right, where you have to have that because of the situation, because of the nature that it affects the property. Now, since the building is in effect on this, not on the lot line, but over the lot line, then there's this legal basis for saying, you got to give it to me. You sold it to me. I got it. Even though it was over the line, I am entitled to an easement for that property, which you now own. And therefore, on the encroachment agreement, at this point, you give me the encroachment agreement, or in fact, you're going to face a lawsuit because you've damaged my property. This is something you should have known. Now, also, how long did he own the property?
Less than a year. They bought it for $30,000, and they sold to us for $190,000. So they've done pretty well from it.
That's good. Okay. I mean, certainly a lawsuit is threatening a lawsuit at this point. They've been putting it back on the seller and saying, "Is this? Well, hey, you should have known. This is something you sold it to me, and there's such a thing as implied evidence of good title. And when he gave you the deed at this particular point, then what did the deed say? It may be a full warranty deed. I don't know what the deed is, but if it's a full warranty deed at this point, he warrants good title. In this case, you didn't have good title. So all of what I'm saying is you've got enough ammunition to go against the prior seller to knock down the $10,000 price.
Okay.
He can hold you up.
That's golden advice right there.
So you knock it down. Yeah. Rather, hey, look, we want to solve the problem to go over there. Maybe you didn't know at this point, but $10,000 is ridiculous. This is the easement. Doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't affect you if you sign the encroachment agreement. All you're going to do is leave, have the right for that building to be there, which you should have, which you really gave to us when you sold it to us, that you knew we had the right to have that building there. So I think you can argue with him at this point. I think you'd be successful, and it sounds like it would work. Also, the fact that, you know, he wants to sell you the other building, which you don't want, but he wants an uptick. That's ridiculous. I mean, not ridiculous. It's a holdup for something that he created. I would throw it back on the seller who sold it to you. He sold you something that was defective. Now, if he knew about it, then there's no problem. That's he can't get out of it. But even if he didn't know about it, he should have known about it.
Right. That's a very interesting perspective. It doesn't matter even if all the documents that we've signed, purchase contract, promissory note, warranty deed, if all of those have provisions in there that hold the seller harmless.
Harmless at this point. You can say hold the seller harmless, but he's never harmless for fraud.
Yeah.
In other words, if he knew it, he's just, you can sign all kinds of things. Yeah. The seller's fair. But if he did something wrong and knew he did something wrong, or has it can appear that he did something wrong, he's liable. Forget that he said whatever it is. In a lawsuit, you win, or probably win, but it's too expensive. It pays almost to give him the 10 grand. So I would go after him, certainly to indicate what your posture is. That he's created this problem, and in addition to that, this defect has caused you a problem. You're going to lose your purchaser.
To sue for damages?
That's right. So there's a point. To the extent if he doesn't solve the problem and you lose your purchaser, you're going to hold him liable for the loss of the deal.
Okay.
That may certainly scare him up enough so that he's going to do it. It doesn't hurt him for him to give you the easement, the encroachment agreement. So, and he's basically holding you up. So the question is, okay, a little bit, but not much.
Excellent. I really appreciate it. That's great advice.
Okay. Good luck. I think you'll come out well.
Thank you.
But throw it on the other side. You're not the bad guy here. He is.
Okay, will do.
I love that. That's great advice, George.
Okay. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Okay, what else we got?
Okay. The next question is from Matthew and Patrick. And they're actually in the car right now on their way to New York. So they said that they asked me to ask the question on their behalf so they don't have all the road noise here.
Okay.
So Patrick and Matthew need to raise about $8 million for a project, and they want to limit, obviously, the number of investment partners in the project. So they will have to approach fairly high net worth individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really it's a four-part question. The first is, what's the best way to approach these people? What information would they be looking for? How would they present it? And in particular, how would they structure the conversation so that the funding source doesn't have too much leverage and exert too much control?
Oh, okay. You got the four parts. All right.
Let's take the
we get to the four parts. All right. Now, the first thing that you would need. and is good, is a really good business plan that you're going to present to your potential investors, indicating what the business plan is, what's going to be built there, how long it's going to take, what you get, how much money they're going to put in, what return they get on their money, do they get a fixed return plus an override, or in fact, do they just get are they equity partners, in which case they share in the equity, and they get whatever the upside is, even though they're just primarily money partners. They're not contributing anything other than money, which is a contribution, but they're not indicating in the building, or they're not doing construction work or anything along those lines. They're just there with the money. So they're entitled to get paid. And in the business plan, you indicate how they're going to get paid and when they're going to get paid. So you say, fine, you're not going to get paid until we see some cash. But once we see cash and we've built the building, we've financed the project, and now we have cash coming, you get a priority of something.
So you're talking about developer fees or potentially any...
Correct. Right. In other words, you say, fine, so we're going to see that if you are an investor, you're entitled to a reasonable return on your money. What the reasonable return would be depends on the risk that they have. So if they get paid first out of the first share of the profits, or as soon as there's any cash that comes out of it, well, okay, then if that's what they get, then they're not going to get the same rate of the same uptick as the owner, the builder of the property, who's then taking the risk. In other words, they're not the sponsor is entitled to more than the investors who put in money somehow. So it's an uptick, could be builder's fee. It could be what happens in the event of a sale. You get after they get their 5%, 8%, whatever you want to indicate that they're getting as a return on their capital. Then what happens? How do we share everything above that? And the sponsor is entitled to get the money and get some advantage. Now, the fact that he does that, he's entitled to it because they made the project happen. The others at that point, it's a financial risk of a financial project that they have, and they're entitled to get a protection, but they have very little to say, should have very little to say about the development of the project. They can be involved what happens in the event of a sale or what happens in the event of financing, so that their interest is protected, so they you can speak to them then on those elements of the development, but they don't control it. Otherwise, you don't let the people who are putting up the money control, because they are not cognizant of what's involved in the project. They're furnishing money, which is entirely different than being helpful in making the project work. So expertise is limited. Dollars. They're entitled to a reasonable return on their money and some indication as to when it comes out. Also, they can get a share of the uptick. That's what happens. So say if the building makes X dollars, at that point you get, here's the return you get on your money. And then above that, we split it, or I get my share, and then you come in, so we have tiers. You get the first, you get a fixed return on your money when there's cash to pay it, not out of the property. When it's cash to pay, yes, we do the financing and you get X dollars. And anything above that, we split or some way, and ultimately you got additional benefits if the project is a huge success, but you don't get hurt terribly if it's just unreasonable.
You know, some investors take the perspective that the project wouldn't occur without them, and therefore,
That's true. That's true. But that doesn't mean the project wouldn't occur. But all they're doing is giving you money. In other words, that's fine. You're going to do it. But if you want to give them control of the project, that's one thing. But when you get control of the project, understand their only function is money, is making it work. That's other than that, they're not adding any expertise unless they have expertise to give. In other words, if they're involved in management of the project because they have management expertise, that's something. Sure, that's worth money. But the average investor doesn't have that. So it depends on who you're asking, who you're getting the money from. Are these money that people that are in the building business, or are they just investors? If the people in the building business, then they're going to give you some expertise. Yes, that's worth something. On the other hand, and they can have a certain control over what the project does to the extent that they have the expertise. But if they're only giving you money and they have nothing there and they're just looking for return, then they shouldn't be in control. because they don't have the expertise.
Got it.
So you can build it, put it into the business plan, what you're planning on doing, and in what areas the investors will have some say as to what goes forward. So if it's a specific type of a mortgage for so many years, it's a standing mortgage, whatever it is, put that in the business. And the business plan should be very, very good. It doesn't have to be accurate. It's based on a lot of assumptions, all right? And as long as you've set it forth, this is the assumption, this is what we anticipate, that's fine. That's good. It doesn't have to happen because it's a plan. So you think it's going to happen. I'm not saying you make it unrealistic, but you dress it up so that it's a win-win. So if you make it a win-win and you dress it up, if it comes to be less than that, it's still something which an investor would be in, would be happy, you know, would be happy to get. So you didn't give me the fair return I had, but nevertheless, you gave me a good return, or it's a good investment.
Okay, very good. All right, next is Michael Mante. Are you on the line? You can press *6 to unmute. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, I am.
Okay, I hear you.
Okay, good evening, gentlemen. Let me pull my question up here. Hi, George. We had a question come in from an investor in our group about how to avoid having your loan called during a down market cycle. So obviously, you know, you can keep making your payment, but any other experience or advice that you have, maybe how to structure the loan to begin with, or and then, you know, general comments on how to survive a down market cycle would be helpful as well.
Well, okay, that's another question. First of all, you can't, when you want to stop a loan from being called, I assume now that for one reason or another, you don't have enough money to pay the mortgage or to pay the loan. Am I right?
Well, the question, I guess, you know, without having gone through a down market cycle, without having had a loan called, you know, there's some scare tactics out there from some people who say, you know, the language in the loan says the bank can call it at any point. You know, have you ever seen that happen when
payment? I've never seen it not really happen when somebody is making the payment, unless they're, okay. Unless for some reason, understand this, that lenders, they're not really, they don't want to run property.
Right.
All they want to do is get paid.
Right.
That's what it is. So they're not going to foreclose willy-nilly. That is just for the purpose of, even though they might have the right to do it because they didn't maintain the ratio of income to value or whatever. But generally speaking, they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
They're not going to call in the loan. Now, on the other hand, understand, calling in a loan does not mean that you're out of it. That's just the starting point. It takes a long time to foreclose. And you have all kinds of defenses against their foreclosing.
Okay.
The bank didn't do this. The bank didn't. They misled me. They didn't fund them. And you make their life miserable. Usually a foreclosure, I don't know what state they're in, but in New York takes like 2 years. All right. 2 years where you're not making the payments.
Okay.
And they want to get the payments. They don't want a loan that's in trouble. So they will generally work with you if you take a firm stand.
Yeah.
So if they say, good, what we're going to do, foreclose, and we'll say, good, do what you want. I'm doing the best I can, but I'm not going to add this. And willy-nilly, I'm not worried over that you're going to end up stealing the property from me. And
So, George, one of the scenarios that post-2008 happened very frequently is something called a maturity default, where, you know, the owner of let's say, a commercial mm-hmm. building made every single payment, but then on renewal of the note, let's say at the end of a 5-year term, the bank came back and said, well, it won't appraise at the original value. So, you know, you need to inject $200,000 of a new equity to get the ratios back in line. Those types of defaults were very common.
I know they were common at that point, but I quite, even though it's there, there's a basic reluctance on the part of the bank to call the loan in the event that you don't meet these ratios. Years or what have you. They make all kinds of threats. They're going to say, we're going to call it. We're going to call you in default. We're going to do it. You're going to lose the property and everything. But generally speaking, they're not going to do it because it's a technical default. It's not a true default. You made the payments, but the value of the property now, it's supposed to be, as far as loan to ratio, it's supposed to be maybe 80% loan And now because the property has gone down in value, it's 110% loan. And therefore, they want to pick up the difference. But that's theoretical. They didn't lose any money.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a technical default. And yes. I'm saying, fine. If they have a technical default, solve it if you can. But if you can't, I wouldn't be concerned about the taking them to saying, good, hey, I made all the payments at that point. I'm hanging there. I can't pick this up at that point. Now, if you want to call a loan, that's your privilege. But meanwhile, I'll make the payments. Why don't we restructure it and overlook this technical default?
Yeah. So they'll push and see what they can get out of you, but that
Absolutely.
Doesn't mean you have to fall over and take it. I mean, Absolutely. what I've always heard is, as long as you're making your payments, that's a performing note. As you know, if they start screwing around and asking for things that they shouldn't have,
you hit it,
and you stop
hit it.
Paying.
No, understand.
All of a sudden,
understand that what happens. All right, and this is important to know. That if they call the loan, they must show it on their books as a non-conforming loan.
Right.
Which means it shows on their books. It goes up ultimately with it when we have to go back and some of the building, whoever is looking over at the regulatory shop. This is now a black mark on their assets.
Yep.
Because it's a non-conforming loan.
Yeah.
And they'll like it depending upon what it is. Now, rather than having a non-conforming loan, you're making all the payments. So it's not horrible.
Right.
All you're always doing, it's a technical default, but they would be reluctant to call the loan and have to show it as a non-performing loan.
No.
Now, certainly, if you said to them, look, fellas, at this, I'll continue on. Let's continue the mortgage in its present form at this. Maybe you don't want to extend the loan. Let's continue it. I'll continue to make the payments and we'll figure out what happens in the future. But if you don't and you call a loan, I'm not making the payments.
Right.
Now you have a true defaulting loan on it, which you have to show up as a non-performing loan while it's in the midst of foreclosure, which generally they don't want to do because it makes them look bad. And it's just a technical default. Will they pressure you? Sure. They'll tell you all kinds of things. They may send you all kinds of letters, all kinds of notice. If you don't, we are going to foreclose. They'll do anything that they can at that point to basically terrorize you. But that doesn't mean they're going to do it.
So you're saying as long as you're paying, it's a performing note, it's a technical default. But if you're saying one more place of leverage on, let's say, the borrower side is to even stop making those payments, which makes it a further black mark on them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
the okay.
one thing. Understand that the lenders are one thing. All they want to do is get paid.
Yes.
Okay. That's all they want to do is to get paid.
Yeah.
At this. So they're not interested in you making waves and they have to go, they have a lawsuit or they have to show things on their books.
Right.
All of a sudden they have this, the bad loan. And according, maybe it's involved all of a sudden it comes out that they get hit with it. This part of the community and the neighborhood finds out that the bank is now pressing the owner of the property on a technical default. They may
right.
not want it. Who knows? But I wouldn't, you know, you got plenty of time to fight it, but I would certainly fight it. I would never do it voluntarily.
Mm-hmm. That's a helpful discussion on that.
However, at this, there's possible at this point you may say, good, in order to give me the extension, I will give you some additional equity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I'm not going to give you what you want. I'll give you some equity. Maybe I'll give you a personal guarantee or give something because you want to get the loan extended.
Sure.
But I wouldn't do it with cash.
Yeah, that's helpful.
That's very good advice, George. I love
Thank
that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Next, this question is from Sonia. And Sonia, are you on the line? Actually, I think I remember her saying that she could not be on the call. So I will ask this for her. So her question is, what's the best way to audit an ongoing project that's geographically
okay.
remote and is being managed by a boots-on-the-ground partner in the project? So, you know, is it just financial statements and cash flow audits? Are there other due diligence items, maybe site visits? Would you hire a third-party inspector? What would you suggest for managing a project that's being managed remotely?
Okay, I would say this: you got to have some way of checking it. One way of checking: get a copy, get copies of all the checks and copies of all the invoices. So you got all the invoices and all the checks, and you can see fine that these in fact being paid, and you get a monthly accounting from the guy who's got the boots on the ground. Because if this is my income, this is the expenses, and basically taking it off the books. Now, you can rely upon that because it's probably factual, unless you're dealing with somebody who's skimming, which is not likely. But then you can have it. So, and these things not can be with the data processing you have on your computer. He can send it to you, make copies of all these things. So it's easy at this point. It doesn't make a difference how far away you are. At that point, all you need is the internet to get all the information. Copies of the invoices, copies of the checks, and copies of the bills, and to follow up. So you can do it even though you're not in the location. But it requires making sure that the party who's doing the actual management at that point is keeping good books and records, which isn't relatively simple.
Would you insist that they actually have a third party doing the bookkeeping, and that only the bookkeeper issues the checks?
No, that's the bookkeeper issues the checks. Yeah, if they have a financial, I don't know. It depends on the size of the project. They may not warrant a bookkeeper. So I don't really care if the manager is going to do it and he has some certain control over the bank account, and then he's going to give you copies of the invoices and copies of the checks. That's good control. Maybe assuming he's an honorable person, which right. I assume it is, and he's going to get fees somewhere along the line for doing the management. So you see it. Now you can also provide how you're going to clear it with the bank that the monies don't go through except some of you've approved them. So it may be required two signatures. However, the fact that the bank account may be in one location and the owner of the property is in another location could prove difficult. But you could also do it with the bank that you require it. It requires two signatures, one of which can be done by a computer. So you can give an authorization of an actual authorization, but just running it through the computer. It's not hand signed, but it's the equivalent. And then it can be proved. So then the bank will go along with it. It's like having two signatures, one of which you can't get. I mean, there's the actual signature, but nevertheless, you get the authority. It's doable.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, it works.
All right, very good. Next question is more of a general question. It's actually one that we're dealing with internally in our business. As developers, we all experience surprises, changes, and problems that affect a project to varying degrees from one day to the next. And, of course, when there's investor monies involved, the general advice from the securities attorneys is disclose, disclose, disclose. And, you know, many problems that we encounter in a project, if left unresolved, they could be a huge issue. But in reality, a lot of them have practical solutions, and a week or two later, they're resolved. And so the question is, when to share something with an investor? On the other end of the spectrum, you obviously don't want to be alarming your investors every week with a new surprise. What are your thoughts on where to set that threshold? Well, let's, in fact, the example that Mark gave earlier, would that be an example of something that the investor should be informed of, given if Mark is prepared to cover the $100,000? Is it something the investor should be informed of?
No. If it doesn't affect them, the answer is no. And the reason I say no at that point, you don't want we're talking about Mark. That problem is what was done, I think, after our discussion. He wouldn't do it the same way again and would have taken more protection. But so telling them that only makes him look bad and doesn't really solve any problem, and he's willing to cover the $100,000. It's not a problem. Now, what I would do as far as the concern is, in your original prospectus, whatever it may be, at this, you've already indicated the game plan. All right, what you anticipate laying it out. This is the project. This is the expenses. This is the money. This is what comes out. This is how we intend to do it. And periodically, you're going to get reports. And this is, it's based on the following assumptions. And you indicate the assumptions. Now, the assumptions at that point should be somewhat realistic. I mean, I'm not saying don't go way overboard and assuming I'm going to get three times the income that was anticipated. But nevertheless, we assume that this is the money we're going to do, and we're going to get that amount of income, and this is the expenses, and this is what it's going to show up in the profit, and this is what we anticipate. Now, that's fine. That's all you need. Now, periodically, I would give the investors a report, and the report is what it is, and tell them the truth. Then I wouldn't alarm them, at this. You don't have to tell them that it's going bad immediately, but you should keep them apprised when it looks like there's going to be a serious situation. And generally, it's just giving them numbers or accountings which they're not even going to look at, to be honest. It's like, you buy stock and the guy says, oh, yeah, it's going to go high, but didn't go low. So what are you going to explain what happened? Yeah, the market changed and therefore it didn't work out. But the average investor at that point is not going to sue unless there has been absolute fraud or you made a total misrepresentation. So as long as you don't guarantee something's going to happen and it didn't happen, or you've laid out that it's ironclad and it's not ironclad, then you don't have the problem. I wouldn't be concerned about it.
If you have a situation, for example, that might result in a 1% cost overrun on the project.
Tough. Hey, are you in real estate?
Absolutely.
Or are we in the dream
Absolutely.
World?
Absolutely.
In the dream world, a real estate project has hazards.
Yep.
All right? It has hazards. It has downs and it has ups. Are you going to tell them when it went three times better than it was mine, that they're going to be very happy? If it goes down, it's a little worse. That's the nature of the business. There's no such thing as guarantees in real estate. There's always something that may come up and changes it. And as long as you relayed it, you gave the information to your investor in an appropriate fashion at an appropriate point in time. And that doesn't mean every week.
Right.
So you say, well, good, we're going to be quarterly reports or annual, semi-annual reports of exactly what's going on. And when you send them these reports, if it's a negative report, you indicate why it was negative. What happened? And you give them an honest count as to what happened. Yeah, the market went down. I thought I could get $5,000 a square foot, and I only got $4,000 a square foot. Therefore, my numbers have changed. That's fine, as long as that's what you told them. But you don't have to tell them every time there's a hiccup in a building job at that point. Forget it. That happens on a constant basis, and that's the nature of the business. Everybody anticipates that there's a possibility that it's not going to go the way you had in mind. And that depending on the climate in at the particular time in the marketplace.
That makes sense.
So just periodic reports, tell them what's going on, but it doesn't have to be too much detail.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of questions we didn't get to tonight, so we'll...
Okay, we'll get to them next
time. Yeah, we'll carry them forward to next month. So thank you so much, George.
Okay, good. Have a happy Thanksgiving, and I'll speak to you next month.
Terrific. Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Thanks, George.
Okay, welcome. Bye now.
Good night.
Thanks, George and Victor. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
There's another monthly edition of the George Ross Mastermind. If you've got a question for George, just send an email to askgeorge@realestateguysradio.com. Make sure you get your questions in at least 2 days before the next mastermind. Successful syndicating.